Up next on Downtown, an Oscar, Grammy, and Golden Globe winner and Emmy Award nominee, a singer, songwriter, actor, author, and recovery advocate. You know him for his tremendous songs like, oh, The Carpenters' Rainy Days and Mondays, I Won't Last a Day Without You, We've Only Just Begun. From A Star is Born, the love theme, Evergreen, that he wrote along with Barbara Streisand, or maybe The Rainbow Connection from The Muppets. You've seen him in movies like Smokey and the Bandit and Baby Driver. We are so happy to welcome Paul Williams to the show this afternoon. First of all, congratulations. Just a few months ago, you celebrated a big birthday. You're peaking at the right time, I would say.
You know what? I feel like a tired 34, but yeah, I hit 80. I can't believe it. And I'm remembering the last 30 years before that. It's a little fuzzy sometimes, but yeah, I also, you know, I have two birthdays. I also have my sober birthday, which is 30 years, and they've been the best years of my life. So, I'm nothing but grateful.
Well, and you've written about that, in your book with Tracy Jackson, Gratitude and Trust. Recovery is not just for addicts. As you look at the scope of your life, how important has that work been for you and to the rest of the world?
You know what? For me, it's the greatest gift I've ever been given. And you know, the effect was interesting because I actually wrote a musical about two years after I got sober. I worked on the Muppet Christmas Carol, wrote all the songs for that, and it's an amazing alignment of my life with, you know, my life and my work. Because it's you know, the main character is Scrooge, who is having a spiritual awakening. And here I am beginning to write again and work again and having a spiritual awakening. I don't think there's anything that's more important to my life, you know, than my recovery. And I think we all have something to recover from. I know that Tracy and I were friends, literally met in Robert Mitchum's bedroom when I think, you know, in 1980, maybe 1981 or something. And I was just rude and, you know, and arrogant and loaded and was just thrilled to be around Robert Mitchum because he was one of my heroes. Oh, and trying to keep up with him put me in rehab twice. But I was just rude. I mean, I threw a comment at her that I won't, I won't repeat on the air. But she walked in and said, I'm a big fan. And I said, well, I hope it, yeah, anyway. And then met her after I was about, I think, the next time I met her was like 2000. So all of a sudden she's meeting somebody that is totally different. And she'd had that experience with other people. And we started talking about the fact that she said, you know, you have, I used the expression in front of her that my choo-choo runs on the twin rails of gratitude and trust. And she said, oh my God, there's a book there. Because what she always wanted is, she said, the rest of us, we all have something to get over, whether it's shopping or affairs with somebody else's husband or whatever it is. The fact is that we all have something to recover. And why don't we have something like what you've been given in the organization that I do not mention by name? But if you're an alcoholic and you're having trouble, go to the front of your phone book and you'll find an organization that can save your life. There's nothing in my life that is more important than my own spiritual connection to it. Just that feeling of safety and being a part of a community Rich, it's not a long story, but I was sent a little article by a kid the other day, and he said, I think you might enjoy this. And I looked at this story, and it was a story of Margaret Mead, you know, the anthropologist. Mm. And she was asked in one of her classrooms, she was asked by a student, what was the first sign of civilization to you? And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, first sign of civilization, a healed femur. And the kid was like, he figured it'd be either a pot or a tool or a weapon, maybe even, you know, but a healed femur. And he said, what do you mean? She said, well, the femur is the longest bone in your body. It connects the hip to the knee. And when you break your femur, in the animal world, if you broke your femur, you were dead. You were lunch.
Right.
You know, but it takes the femur about 15 weeks to heal. And when we found a healed femur, we realized that what had happened is that either one person or a group picked this person up, put them someplace where they were safe, brought them food and water, and allowed them the time to heal. And I went, oh, my God, that's the perfect description of the organization that saved my life. That's the description of the recovering community that put my life back together for me. There's nothing that's happened to me that's more important than the chance to get my windshield clean and begin to clean up the wreckage of my past as well.
That's a great story. How would you describe gratitude, Paul? Is it is part of it acceptance?
Absolutely is part of acceptance, but it's also just over the hill. There's usually a reason for anything, you know, that is a disappointment. And I talk about it in the book, that no is a gift. You know, no is an absolute gift. I was newly sober I was probably 6 years, 7 years sober when I was cast in a movie called The Frighteners, and shooting in New Zealand with Michael J. Fox. And I was like, oh, my God, this is it. This is going to make me Paulie the big star again. Because the career that I thought I had in the 80s, that career disappeared, and I got sober in 1990. You know, but so here it is. It's like 1996 or something. And I get this movie that is just, wow. I mean, this is a great role. This is going to put my life back together. And all of a sudden, we're working out the contract, they're buying the plane tickets, and I get a call and they say, you know what, we really wanted John Astin for the role, but he was busy and the movie he was going to make just got canceled, so bye.
Oh.
And my absolute first thought, and this is the gift of recovery, my first thought was, wow, I wonder what's coming that's cool. Because there's the reason, you know, it's like, I don't think that my life has been plotted by somebody, but my thinking, I think, affects, you know, I think thoughts become things. And what happened is I felt an energy that was like, I let this go, as, there's your word, acceptance, and then I assume that something loving is gonna, and wonderful is coming. And so no is a gift, because all of a sudden the phone rings. And it's this organization called the NSAI, which is Nashville Songwriters Association International. And they go, would you come on down? We have a thing called Tin Pan South, and if you come on down, we'd like to give you a plaque. And I went, a plaque? Always room for a plaque. There's always a crack in the wall or something. So I go to Nashville, and for 7 years I felt no real connection to music. It's just been gone. And there's something in the water there. And the next thing I know, I'm in love with a couple of people's writing, and I'm sitting down with a stranger, and we're looking at each other, and we write a song about getting sober called You're Gone. Big hit for Diamond Rio. Mm-hmm. I'm back. There is a letting go of the reins in my life that for the last 30 years, and I think in some ways even before, that where I just, you know, I had that sense of being cared for. I get up in the morning and I say, you know, I say, lead me where you need me, big amigo. That's my morning prayer in a heartbeat. It's like, here are the reins to my day. You can see over the hill. I can't, but lead me where you need me. and it's the way I've lived my life, and it's just been a total gift.
We're talking with Paul Williams here on Downtown. When you were a young guy growing up, did you feel like an outsider?
Always. Well, wait a minute. That was too quick an answer. No, I was an outsider, but I don't think I felt it until I got the substance out of my life. I think that before I drank like an alcoholic, I acted like one. I went to 9 schools by the time I was in the 9th grade. I was 4'6" when I graduated high school. My dad died in a car wreck drunk when I was 13. I come from a long line of short drunks, is my joke, but the fact is there's something in the Williams DNA in my family. Both my brothers were alcoholics and both got sober. My dad, but I was always a new kid at the school, a new school. I also was given shots to make me grow when I was about maybe 8 or 9 years old. And it's interesting because the doctor had no idea what he was doing, gave me a male hormone because he thought that would make me grow. All it did is it started to, you know, knit the bones, and it kicked me into puberty like at nine. And everybody, like my dad noticed, it's like, you know, all of a sudden I had no interest in my toy chest, but my Aunt Edna's chest was pretty exciting for me. And they went, wait a minute, get this kid off these hormones. This is wrong. And what it did is it slowed down my own body clock. So when I was in high school, I looked like I belonged in third grade. I mean, you can see me in movies in my early 20s, you know, and I think I hit puberty like at 20 or something. So the high school years were really wonderful. But you know, you look at me in my early 20s in a movie like The Loved One with Jonathan Winters, where I'm playing a 14-year-old and I'm 22. Or in The Chase with, you know, a small part in a movie with Marlon Brando, and I'm playing a 16-year-old. And I'm 26 at that time, you know. So, yeah, I did. But I think that feeling of, you know, recognizing that you're just kind of, I mean, I just kept moving. I kept moving. Every year I moved. I moved to a clean slate. And I just didn't think about how it felt until I got sober. I was about 5 years sober when I went, wow, I mean, your childhood looks like Dickens. This is outrageous. Why, you know, why weren't you screaming and crying and saying this has to be fixed? I don't know. I think it's part of an interior life that it feels much more accepting and loved. And to me, the elegance of kindness is the most important thing in the world. You know, when we see people acting out in a violent fashion, no matter how right they may think they are, then my first thought is, you know, is there a way to approach this in pure, sweet kindness and with an open mind to listen to the other side and collectively do something wonderful instead of, and we saw, I mean, I'm still kind of ringing with the residue of the invasion of D.C. yesterday. So I think that, you know, and I spend a lot of time on the Hill and with friends on both sides of the aisle, but it was pretty hard to watch that yesterday.
Yeah, it sure was. You talked about your father dying when you were 13. My mom died when I was just a couple of months shy of my 13th birthday. And I've talked about this with Jimmy Webb. He was a teenager when his mom died as well. I didn't learn this till later in life when I sort of had that awakening of my own, but did losing your dad at such a young age, and really losing your mom too, because you ended up moving away, did that impact your relationships with people?
Oh my God, you know, you're really good at this, Rich, because you know what you eventually find out, or what I eventually found out, is that, you know, I was I spent my life writing codependent anthems. You know, the songs are "I Won't Last a Day Without You" is not really a healthy thought. You know, I write a lot of pick me up and love me songs, and I did the same thing in my life. I've been married to Mariana for 3 years. This is my third marriage. We've been married since 2005, which is a personal best. And what I think I've discovered about the loss of especially my mother when I was shipped off to live with an aunt and uncle, is that I took that need, the mask of that need, and I kept putting it on different faces. You know, like I'd meet somebody and fall in love like that. It was just, you know, immediate. And you know, after the relationship which lasted however long it lasted, was over, I'd look back and I remember thinking when you know, a really important relationship in my life is a girl that I was living with and engaged to, when I was drinking and using, and she said, "You know what? I love you too much to watch you die. So I have to leave." And it was like, "Oh my God! All I wanted was her back." And with a little bit of distance and a little bit of clarity, I looked at that relationship and I went, "You know, first of all, you were 20 years older than her, and all that need was you didn't need. She was wonderful for the message she gave me." But the need that I was feeling was not her; it was my mother. And I would ask you the same thing: Do you feel that there is a translation of that need in your adult life that maybe you didn't recognize right away?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I found, and I needed someone else to bring it to my attention, was that in relationships, I always had a foot out the door, and it was, listen, let's make sure that I don't get hurt. I'm going to be the one to leave. They're not going to leave me like my mom did.
You know, every now and then, you know, I do a lot of interviews and a lot of, you know, I had a blessed life, and I love it when somebody, you know, is interested in, you know, I love the attention, of course, and all. But I have to tell you that when we're in the midst of a conversation like this, after about, what, how many minutes have we been talking? It's a real gift. It really is. It's wonderful to get to some substance and all. And so thanks already, Rich.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So, well, let me go one more step down that road. When you were writing songs and when you were using, was in some way that songwriting a form of self-medication? Did that allow you to explore some dark places, but more as an observer?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the reason I became a songwriter, to me, I love music, yeah, but not nearly as much as I needed the therapy. And I think that it was the cheapest therapy in the world to sit down by yourself and pick up a guitar and start going, you know, some sleepless night, if you should find yourself alone, let me be the one you run to. Why am I writing about that? You know, let me be the one you run to when you need someone to run. I mean, it's, right through Daft Punk and the, you know, the songs I wrote for them. Touch, I remember Touch. You know, the pictures came with Touch. A painter in my mind. We're talking about like an awakening awareness of need and longing and all these things. I know that when my use, my addiction. I mean, I started out and I played with a little bit of herb and I drank and I, you know, in the '60s, we all, you know, tune in, whatever, drop out. I never dropped out and everything, but I played around with a little, you know, a few hallucinogenics and whatever, but my addiction didn't really kick into the point where it really just brought everything productive in my life to a halt until the 80s. You know, the 70s were amazing. And you know, the reason I became a songwriter is because I was an out-of-work actor. One more time, no is a gift and all. But I think that the things that happened to us that we did not process by feeling when we were kids, when we had those losses, when we were kicked around like that, and those things that we're not dealt with, you know, that we deal with at this point in our lives, in the interim, the bridge to that for me, and the, in a sense, the medicine, the, you know, the healing medicine was in picking up a guitar or sitting down next to Roger Nichols and having him play me the melody for Let Me Be the One and me writing the lyrics, for me to write songs about loss of being left, you know. When the first hit when I got sober was a country hit called You're Gone. The good news is I'm better for the times we spent together. The bad news is I'm gone. You're gone, which is Diamond Rio. And so I think that a bridge to my own health, you know, has been music, and it's also been a sense of the, you know, if I sit down to write songs for the Muppets, the music that exists before I write is the music of my comfort with those and respect for those amazing performers and for Jim Henson and Frank Oz and Dave Golds, who does Gonzo. It's like the relationship creates the music that then comes out of me, you know, for the project, whether it's Muppet Christmas Carol or Emmett Otter or even for sure the Muppet movie. It's there's a music in the relationship. It's almost what I was talking about at the beginning of this conversation. That when you get someplace where you're hearing each other as well as we're hearing each other, as far as the substance of what we're talking about, we're clearly hearing each other in a way that opens up trust and the like. That happens to me in collaborative experiences. And it's a remarkable thing to experience. All a gift. And when most times when you talk about your gift, it's like, I have the gift to write. No, I don't have the gift to write. I have the gift of being staying out of the way and letting the feelings create, you know, the words, the music, and whatever kind of muse is the driving force to get these things down. But again, it's the beginning of the music is is in the relationships, you know.
Well, let's talk about the music. Is the story true about We've Only Just Begun? You and Roger Nichols had written it for, I think it was the Crocker Bank, and Richard Carpenter saw the ad on TV and reached out to you. Is that true or just a little urban legend?
Yeah. No, you just told the story. Absolutely. You know, Roger and I were writing for, you know, we had written one song that the Carpenters recorded. We had the B-side of Close to You. We wrote, they were at A&M Records, as Roger and I were staff writers there. And what happened is there was the commercial was going to be written by Tony Asher. Tony Asher, I don't know if you know who Tony Asher is.
Yeah, he had written with Brian Wilson, yeah. Right?
Oh, exactly. God only knows what I'd be a great lyricist, you know. So Tony calls Roger. They were old buddies. And he said, look, I've been hired to write this commercial for a bank. I went skiing, and I just broke my hand. It's the hand I write with, and about pain pills and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he's like, I can't do it right now, but I recommended you and Paul. And so Roger turned to me and said, I'm writing this middle of the road music with Roger and all. But inside, I'm like, I'm rock and roll. Don't mess with me. I'm black leather and white light. And Roger says, this bank commercial. I said, I don't want to write a bank commercial. You know, come on, Roger. He said, well, there's a creative fee. And I went, let's write this blank commercial. exactly. Whiplash. You know, so much for years. You know, and I think we wrote it in probably an hour. I mean, we were in the studio. Mixing a demo to another song, and Roger, played me the melody, and I think they, in some ways, they came at the same time. But Roger always wrote the music first, so I'm sure that he played me. And it was a commercial that showed a young couple getting married, driving off, they kiss, they drive off in the sunset. There is no way in the world this song was going to be probably recorded, and it certainly wasn't going to be a hit. The number one album at the time was In a Gata Da Vida. I mean, I don't know how much further you get away from what is commercially happening, you know. But so I write, We've Only Just Begun to Live, White Lace and A Kiss for Life, and sing it. And as you tell it, you know, Richard Carpenter, who, when the Carpenters signed it at A&M, nobody knew who we were. I mean, it's like we'd been, everything Roger and I were writing, it had, you know, was getting recorded. It was B-sides and it was album cuts. We had never really heard our songs on the radio, maybe a little middle of the road station once in a while, hear Steve Lawrence singing Drift Away or something. But nobody knew us. The head of publishing at A&M showed up at the door to our offices and said, want to introduce you to these guys who are going to be recording for A&M. Karen, Richard, this is Paul and Roger. And they knew everything. You know, I mean, we had an album cut, by the Crawling Spiders or whatever. They would go, I love that song on the crawl. I mean, there was no Crawling Spiders, but literally, you know, just it was amazing to meet somebody that knew what we had done, you know, and who, you know, the kind of stuff we did. So we had a great opportunity to write for them. And we wrote when Richard called. And we said yes. It was so amazing to watch what that voice, Karen's voice, does to any listener. The thing took off, and the next thing you know, every high school is using it as their theme for the yearbook, and it was the beginning of a really remarkable collaboration. So grateful for that. There's an example of pure gratitude.
You won the Oscar for collaborating with Barbara Streisand on Evergreen from A Star Is Born. A great song, obviously. Now, my favorite from the soundtrack is With One More Look at You. And I understand that you based that on a line that James Mason said in the 1954 version of the movie.
First of all, when I met my wife in like 2001, whatever, she said, you wrote my second favorite song. And I went, second favorite song. Okay. First thing I had to ask is, what's your favorite song? And she said, what are you doing the rest of your life? Marilyn Allen Bergman. And you just go, oh my God, of course. What's the second? She said, With One More Look at You. It's my favorite song from the movie. I mean, I wrote most of the songs in the movie with Kenny Asher. And yeah, we the first thing we did is we sat down and watched we had offices out at Warner Brothers, or Barbara did rather. And the first thing they did is arrange for us to see the earlier versions of What Price Hollywood, Star Is Born with Judy Garland, whatever, and James Mason. And there was just this wonderful thing where James Mason would say, you know, like, hold on, I just want to take another look at you, you know, and she would stop and flutter her eyes and all. And we loved that. So there was a song that at the end of the movie, when he's passed away, when he's had his car wreck, he's dead, John Norman is gone, she finds this song that he was working on. And that's the first thing that she actually called me when she asked me to work on the picture. She said, I want that song. And I want something like You and Me Against the World. I said, well, I wrote that with Kenny Asher. Let me bring it. And incidentally, I immediately walked into that first meeting with all the songs, you know, notated where the songs would go and what the two bands would be like and all. And Barbara was and John Peters were like, that's not what we were asking. We asked you about one song. But she said, you're not intimidated. I said, no. I was totally intimidated, but I said, no, you know, this is a wonderful story, and I'd love to do it. But yeah, it was just, I actually had dinner with James Mason after the picture came.
Oh, wow.
And James and his wife, and I said, you know, James, there's a line that, you know, I don't know if you've seen A Star Is Born yet, but there's a line, there's a song in the picture that was inspired by a line of yours. From your version of A Star Is Born. He said, oh, really? I said, yeah. You know, it's called With One More Look at You, and I sang a little of it to him, and it's totally based on your thing. You have this thing where you say, I just want another look at you, and he says, oh, I don't remember. It's been such a long time since I've seen it. And his wife said, oh, bullshit. You were watching it on about 3 in the morning last week. And it's just one of those moments where you're sitting there with somebody that you've just worshipped for all these years, you know, and again, back to that word gratitude. Yeah.
Paul, we're closing in on 30 minutes, but do you mind going a few extra minutes? Because I'm having so much fun here.
Yeah, no, I'm good. Based on the quality of this conversation, you know, there's no time limit right now.
All right, fantastic. I have to ask about Rainbow Connection. Why do you think that song has resonated with so many people? What is it that gives that song so much power?
I think it begins with Jim Henson. I think it begins with, you know, the music before the music. When you're standing there and you're talking to somebody that you loved, you know, on the road, my road band and I would wake up in some little town somewhere in America, in mid America, and open one eye because I was usually, you know, probably hungover. Open one eye and watching Sesame Street, and we loved, you know, Bert and Ernie and Animal and all these characters. So I was a huge fan when I met Jim in England. I went over to do the Muppet Show and guest, and he asked me to do a thing called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, which was a wonderful little 1-hour special. I think that was kind of my audition.
Great, by the way. I love that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a labor of love. And the easiest writing I ever did in my life has got to be for the Muppets. It just pours out of me. There's something about that relationship that just opens up my heart. And we're a good match. But I know that Jim was, you know, he said, look, I think I was being auditioned for the Muppet movie, to write the songs for the Muppet movie. And which I always thought Joe Raposo would do because he was so wonderful with the Muppets and wrote It's Not Easy Being Green and all. So, but Jim asked me and I said, can I bring in Kenny Asher? We had just finished working on A Star Is Born it was just a really great collaborative experience. And I wanted the level of sophistication in the music that I knew Kenny would bring in because I write words and he writes music and all. But the process, again, it's sometimes what you wind up writing is an absolute accident. And the classic example is Rainbow Connection. So we know it's basically a road picture. It's how the Muppets get together and blah, 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 on the road to where they're looking for frogs to become rich and famous. So Jim says, we're going to start the movie with, we find Kermit, and he's in the swamp and sitting on a lily pad. It turned out to be a log because it was easier to hide Jim in a log than a lily pad. But I said, okay, what's he doing? He said, he thought a minute and he went, playing the banjo, you know. I said, okay, so he's playing the banjo. This is the opening song. This is the I Am song for Kermit the Frog, who is to me a monstrous star and as real as you are. And so it's like, what became the perfect song that was something to kind of reach for? We always thought was When You Wish Upon a Star. You know, when Jiminy Cricket takes off his hat, looks at the sky and sings, when you wish upon a star, something happens to you. It's spectacular. And we wanted that for Kermit. So we thought about the fact that he has water, he has air, he has refracted light, he has rainbows. So we started writing. And look what we did to ourselves. Here's the opening. Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. Rainbows have nothing to hide. Oh, my God. Oh, look what we just did. We totally wrote ourselves into a corner. Like, we just dismissed anything magical about rainbows. And then look what happens. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong. Wait and see. Someday we'll find. What happens in that moment is absolutely what is at the heart of Kermit's character. Kermit at that moment becomes a member of the audience looking for, you know, the Rainbow Connection. Because he says, so we've been told, and some choose to believe it. Now he is sitting with the audience as a believer when he's surrounded by non-believers. It opens the song up to a way to offer ideas that are his whimsy that have a deeper spiritual meaning than... Then I mean, I don't know if Kenny and I put it in there or somebody else is kicking us around, but my favorite line in the song is, who said that every wish would be heard and answered if wished on a morning star? Somebody thought of that. Someone believed it. Look what it's done so far. That's flat out my philosophy. I believe that thoughts become things. I believe that, you know, that when we're coming from a loving place, we are powerful. And it just, it's again, keyword gratitude, that the mistake that we made at the beginning, you know, was the opportunity to respond to that took us to a place where the song had a deeper meaning. I think the connectedness of the song to the world today, and I saw, you know, the young man sang it on The Voice and won the next week, this last thing of The Voice, to have all the people that have, you know, I mean, I've recorded it with Willie Nelson and I singing that song is as good as life ever gets for a songwriter. I think that if you really check the headwaters of why the song works, you got to look at Jim Henson. You have to look at his energy. You have to look at the wisdom and the kindness that is there in the characters that he created that led us through this process.
All right. Now, my favorite Paul Williams song, it's hard to pick, but it's one that you did yourself and was a hit for you. Some of my favorite lyrics of all time, like an old familiar poem that still won't rhyme. I could get back to the place, but not the time. Love that song so much.
Waking Up Alone. Oh. Wow. Oh, you are totally... that so touches me because it's a song... If I ever try to talk about songwriting to other songwriters and express, you know, elements of a song and what they do, if you listen to the I'm stunned, Rich. I totally didn't expect that. That bridge is the best illustration I've ever written of what a bridge is supposed to do. Take the story to a different place. Oh, waking up alone. I took my chances on a one-way ticket home, growing tired of strangers and the kind of life I'd known. Thought the time for settling down had come at last. Yes, I hope to find the future in my past. Take the story to the next step. Walk with me, darling, where the wheat fields used to be. I will tell you stories of my times across the sea. You're the legendary girl I left behind. Can't begin to count the times you crossed my mind. Most important story point coming up.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, your children, why the youngest looks just like you. Oh, no. Damn it.
And then you break my heart with she's the picture of her mother. Oh, God, you're killing me.
You know, it's just, he got there too late. And again, it's just, and I don't know where they come from or why, but when I wrote that alone, and it's one of my favorite songs ever. And you just, and nobody knows about that song, Rich. You know, we have to get a little place together. You're going to remember the song. You know, it's like.
Well, that's a great album. I love that entire album.
Old-fashioned love song, yeah. Michael James Jackson produced that. And Michael James Jackson's whole thing was to not hide me behind it. He said, let's get your frail little, he didn't say it then, but I look back and I, let's get that frail little voice of yours out front so people can hear what you're feeling. And he left it very bare, and with the best musicians in the world, Lee Sklar on bass, you know, from James.
Oh, yeah.
Basically James Taylor's backup band, you know, the Section, you know, with Craig Derge on keyboard. It just, what a gifted life I've had.
Now, you said you were a failed actor, but you were everywhere in the 1970s in film Smokey and the Bandit, Phantom of the Paradise. How much fun was that for you to have a chance to be in some movies that people just loved?
You know what, it's been remarkable. First of all, the only time I ever felt like I was absolutely living my childhood dreams is when I walk on a movie set. I just spent 2 seasons on Goliath with Billy Bob Thornton.
Which is great series, by the way. We've had a number of guests. Our friend Mark Duplass was on there, and that's such a good series. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, and Billy Bob is like, I mean, talk about a master. And again, you know, what does he have in common with Jim Henson? There is this kind of quiet and welcoming energy about this really kind, really person, amazing person who, and working with him on the set, incidentally. I mean, first of all, you say what you pay attention to the lines. And then when you shoot it, you just, you know, whatever comes out of you is what you're feeling. And you get so much permission from Billy Bob to, you know, but he speaks so softly. And it's like you're in the room. Then you watch him on television or when you're seeing the work, it's just he is letting you in the most amazing way that is all internal. And a lot of times, I mean, I couldn't hear him. He'd say things that I'm watching the show. There was one episode where I walk in, and he's in bed where he's got the breathing machine on, and I've just broken into his room with, you know, and I smack his legs and wake him up. I said, I could have cut your throat, for God's sake. That, you know, that the lock on that door couldn't keep a monkey with a credit card could get through that. And he said, one just did, you know. But he said it so softly, I didn't respond at all. And just keep plugging away. And then I look at it on HBO or on Amazon, and it's like, I hear the line, and it kills me. It's like, he's so creative. The first big movie I did was called The Loved One. I remember walking on the set, seen, there's John Gielgud, there's Jonathan Winters, who I worship, you know, we stayed friends with for years. It's the most magical experience in the world for me to walk on those, and where you go to that other place that you inhabit a character and you follow a storyline that is just, I mean, it's just, talk about your childhood dreams come true. That's it. I mean, I love walking into a recording studio with a big orchestra. I still, the best part of doing what I do for a living is I don't have to give up my fan card. So when I walk into a room and I see Quincy Jones, who I've known since the 70s, I still go, wow, that's Quincy Jones. Wow. There's a part of me that would walk on the set and be sitting there talking to Billy Bob, and I have loved him, you know, forever. And it's still going, man, you are sitting here about to step in front of the camera with the master, with Billy Bob, you know. So I love it. I just love it.
Was it on the set of The Chase that you actually started writing songs for the first time?
Sitting there watching Marlon Brando and Robert Redford in the scene at a junkyard where Robert Redford, is an escaped convict, is hiding in the junkyard, which is set fire by these four teenagers. That I was one of the four teenagers. I was sharing a dressing room with a kid named Mark Seaton, who had a beautiful guitar. And most of the time, like for about 3 months, we're shooting at night, and we're kind of waiting. I had, I think, three lines in the movie, you know, but we're a lot of time just sitting there watching. And when I picked up his guitar, I went, "Don't pick that up, that's a Martin." So I went out and I bought a little guitar, and I had no idea how to. I didn't know an A chord was an A chord. I know that when I put my fingers certain places, it sounded good. So I'm like trying to teach myself to play guitar, and I'm sitting on the steps of our little motorhome that Mark and I had shared. And I'm watching the scene, and I just, to myself, I go, "Bubba, bubba, bubba, come out wherever you are. Oh, we're going to come in and get you." And we're just making it up on the spot as Robert Duvall is walking by. And my life is about to change because Robert Duvall stopped, and he says, "What's that?" I said, "It's the guitar. Isn't it cool?" He said, "No, not the guitar. What were you just singing?" And I thought, I'm in trouble now. I just made it up. I used to come with me. And when I was, "Jesus, now what?" So he walks me over to Arthur Penn, who is the director, you know, just coming off of The Miracle Worker. I mean, he's brilliant. And I'm totally intimidated again and not acting. But he said, "Show him." I said, "It's the guitar." I mean, not the guitar, show him the song. So I sang, "Bubba, bubba, bubba, bubba." And he didn't say anything, but he went, "Okay, hold on a second. Bring the Kodak around and light all the fires. Paul, stand up by the. You know what? Bring the car around. Let's have put the kids in the car. Paul, get you by the barbed wire. Hold on. Okay, roll it. Do it." And I sing the song, and it's in the movie. And it's like I was 2 years later that I became a songwriter. But it's as if the universe had just given me a billboard of direction and said, "You know what? You made it up. Somebody else liked it, and they preserved it for all time and put it in this multi-million-dollar monstrous film and everything. Maybe you might think about writing songs." Took me 2 years to do it, but I mean, the only thing that matches that is when I was about 15 years old, I climbed onto a boat in Long Beach. I live in Huntington Beach. But with some of my buddies, and we stole booze off the back of the boats, and then I tried to swim back across this little body of water with a bottle of booze in each hand, and I almost drowned. And when I was newly sober, I told that to a woman who had a lot of time, and she said, "Ah, a billboard." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "Well, the universe was showing you that alcohol was going to drown you."
Wow.
But you didn't notice then. I said, "Well, that's amazing." So now I look at my life and I find the billboards that I went about alcohol and addiction. A little later on, I get a billboard about the fact that what you're supposed to be doing is writing songs. And the great thing is that as we roll along through this and everything, I have now a solid expectation for more opportunities, and when the river meets the sea at the end of my life and everything, I will look back and go, I'm going to hate to say goodbye to this life because it was, I mean, it's been great fun being Paul Williams, and I was given so much more than I deserved, and I love every minute of it.
I have to ask you, because it was such a great movie, one of the best movies in terms of its use of music, I think, in recent years. It was so great to see you as the butcher in Baby Driver.
Wow, yeah. Edgar Wright. Oh, I love Edgar Wright. You know, and Edgar did, as a kid, he did Bugsy Malone. You know,
that's right.
And, so he was one of the kids in Bugsy Malone at school or whatever. He's was a big fan of Phantom of the Paradise. And he's just been so wonderfully supportive, a really good friend. And he said, "One of these days, I'm going to find something fun for you to do." And You know, I mean, all of his pictures are just, if you haven't seen Shaun of the Dead, you know, you've got to see Shaun of the Dead. You know, it from the very beginning, he's so unique. And the way he uses music, and it's interesting you point that out, because it's, I think, the most unique thing about the picture is the way he uses music in the film and all. It's a great fun ride, and you know, he asked me to do The Butcher with dialogue that you couldn't really do like what I do on any of the stuff that I'm doing with Goliath, with anybody, where you're getting the heart of the dialogue, and you kind of process it and say it in your own way. This is something. This was like a 2-page scene of dialogue that is all about comparing, pig parts. You know, that's why they call him the butcher. You know, to various weapons. You know, and it was the most difficult dialogue I ever had to learn in my life, and all. So it was like, now I want to do one sometimes. I want the chance to work with him again and all. But I would like something where I can kind of soak it up and let it kind of sweat out in its own way, as opposed to following that roadmap. Was difficult. It was tough, but he's fantastic and a good friend.
You've also been doing great work for more than a decade now as president of ASCAP, defending the rights of songwriters at a time when, I don't know, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that your best work is being stolen by these streaming services, with songwriters getting virtually nothing in return.
Well, you know, the thing is much better than it was, but you're right. It's been since 2009. It's been the great honor of my life to be trusted to this position and to make sure that songwriters are compensated in a something close to a fair fashion, you know. And it's getting better. It's getting better. And we've had cooperation. You know, the great thing about the legislators in the House and in the Senate is that they have they love music, and it's one of the few things that they can actually come together and not try to rip each other's throats out. You know, should we do something here? You know, we went through the whole thing with Napster, where music was being grabbed and there was nothing, and then in streaming, we've been bound by a consent decree. You know, that kind of has us going into economic battles with one hand tied behind our back. We had a very, very big break and worked hard for in creating the Music Modernization Act, which right. created an MLC, which is the Music Licensing Committee. Is essentially what it does. The MLC is the fee for the mechanical right is being dealt with in a way that properly can take the time to identify who the creators are, who the publishers and writers are. The guessing game of who to pay for this music is being solved, as long as you make sure that they have your information, all of the information on who owns the copyright, who wrote it, who publishes it, you know, that you can now, instead of a black box collecting money that they don't know who to send to, the money will wind up where it belongs, and the numbers are coming up. You know, that it's I describe Beth Matthews, who is the brilliant CEO of ASCAP, as the engine. We have an amazing board of directors of 12 publishers and 12 composers and songwriters. I'm the hood ornament. I will walk into an office and say, I'm Paul Williams, I'm an American songwriter, and I need to talk to you. And somebody like a congressman from Georgia will say, and your Lilleen is smoking the bandit. God damn, I love that movie. Well, let's talk. What can I do for you? And you know what? That's what I do. That's the gift that I'm able to bring to it, and make them aware. You know, and bring guys like Jimmy Webb into the office with me and say, this is Jimmy Webb. He's, and they go, I know who Jimmy Webb is, and what a treat to meet you guys. And what can I do for you? And what they've been willing to do in recent years is really lean into our to kind of cut some ropes to give us a little more freedom, a little understanding, and we are in the years ahead, I think, going to see it get better and better and better. We have almost 800,000 members of ASCAP, and thanks to the brilliance of Beth Matthews and the cooperation of an amazing staff and a board of directors. Songwriters, for the last 3 years have been over $1 billion, and it was, we're a not-for-profit organization, so every penny after the operating cost goes to the writers and publishers. I'm really, really proud of what we're able to do, and I want to do it for a couple more terms, and as long as they want me, I'll say yes.
Paul, it has been an absolute delight to talk with you. I have been a fan for a long, long time, but especially I appreciate the way you live your life, and you walk the walk out there.
Well, it's wonderful I'm hearing some information from you that tells me that we have a future together.
That sounds great. Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
My treat. Thanks so much, Rich.